Today at Radio Verulam, we're once again speaking to one of your local MPs to get the answers to your questions. And thank you this month from everybody here at Radio Verulam. This has been the record month for questions, involvements with the political broadcast. Thank you so much, and please do keep those questions coming in. I know some people will be disappointed that they didn't have their questions answered this month, but we talk to our politicians every month, so there's a chance when they're back again next month, if your questions are relevant, they will be asked then. But without further ado, let's go in to the Q&A session. So welcome back to the show, Bambos. We took a break last month in line with parliamentary recess, but the work goes on, doesn't it? Was it just as busy for you as always during this time?
Yeah, it was very busy because we had the whole Afghan situation, and I had a number of constituents who had family members and people they knew in Afghanistan who were stuck over there. And some are still over there. I've got two Chevening scholars who are stuck in Afghanistan, and they made every effort to get to Kabul airport, and they're just stranded now.
And so what happens with Parliament in that situation? Do you get called back in? Are you given a bit of warning?
It's not automatic, but if the Speaker, in conjunction with the Prime Minister, agree that Parliament should be recalled, then Parliament is recalled. And this was one of those situations where it was right for Parliament to get recalled. And we had a one-day debate about the situation in Afghanistan. There was a statement from the Prime Minister and lots of questions. And then there was, it was a debate, basically. It wasn't just a statement, it was a debate. But there was lots of unhappiness as to how things were left by Britain in Afghanistan. It was just quite... quite disappointing that there wasn't more forethought given to getting people out of Afghanistan and more planning, with bearing in mind we knew we were going to leave months and months ago.
Now, that is a negative situation there, and we hope that there is a positive resolution whenever and however that can be. But since we last spoke, there's actually been a turnaround in terms of your party politics, and you may be feeling a positive mood at the moment, because the latest polls show that Labour are actually in the lead at the moment. What do you think has changed in this time?
Well, I think the government have had a number of missteps. They do say that the oppositions don't win elections, but governments lose them. And I think things like the handling of Afghanistan, this debacle with the increase in national insurance to pay for extra funding for the NHS and social care, and various other things that, Gavin Williamson's ineptness in pretty much everything that he was doing when he was education minister. So things like that, Raab being on holiday, it all gives a degree of, it gives the impression that the government isn't doing what, they're not acting as a people who should be running the country. So I think things like that do have an impact.
Previously, though, we talked about an inability for Labour to get the message across. Do you think that this is now being combated?
I do. I think that there have been some, really good statements from Rachel Reeves. Wes Streeting has announced his 10x10 strategy to get... to try and address child poverty, particularly with young children. So there's lots of policies being announced. We'll hear some more at conference. I think people aren't beginning to listen to what the Labour Party has to say. And also Keir Starmer's being, he's been out and about, so people are getting to see him and know him a bit more. And I think they're liking what they see.
Well, continuing on that in terms of what Labour have been saying, you as a party have been discussing nationwide issues in terms of a COVID recovery plan. You published one with many saying that the opposition now has a clearer view than the government on how to help the country get back on its feet. Would you like to quickly discuss the main points of this plan?
Yeah, well, clearly we need to... there's if you look at where we are, so we've got issues around people are being still furloughed. They're going to come off furlough at the end of the month. So that could lead to people losing their jobs. We've got universal credit sort of coming to an end as well. And you've got the hike coming up in national insurance contributions. I think we want to make sure that we have an economy that works for everyone. So I think we need to see more investments. We need to make sure that our high streets have more investment, that, you know, people have work that pays for them, and that, you know, we do rebuild our communities. So I think there's a lot of stuff to be getting stuck into there.
One thing that the party and your party leader, Sir Keir Starmer, explained that might stop this recovery or at least hinder it is the government's social care plans. Boris Johnson is planning a tax rise, which means that a landlord who rents out dozens of properties won't pay a penny more, as your party leader said, but the tenants working in full-time jobs will. What is an alternative system that Labour feels should be used to fund this?
Well, there are a number of options. I think certainly looking at sort of property and wealth, they would be the two areas that we would look at. But also there's loads of money that's offshore that isn't taxed. So I think we need to look at sort of going after those who aren't paying tax because of their way that they're... companies are set up and the way that they've managed to move these LLPs offshore. So I think there are things that can be done. I think sort of certainly trying to take the weight off people that are on low incomes, are hardworking, and you know, are struggling. I mean, I think if you're a young person, over 50% of your income would be taken up in tax, and that's really not acceptable if you're just starting out in your first job.
Let's move on to the issue that we raised at the top of the show, though. As Shadow Minister for Immigration, what work has been done to help refugees from Afghanistan? And then we'll move on to what's happened in your local constituency. But first and foremost, what have you been doing, and what kind of work has been done in Parliament?
So we've been trying to get clarity from the government. So the people who have been airlifted out of Afghanistan, many of them are in hotels, both in London and outside London. But it's a bit sketchy as to what support they're getting in those hotels. And I think we want to make sure that they're not staying in hotels any longer than they have to. But those are only the ones that have been airlifted. I think the government have said that their focus is now going to turn to people that have left Afghanistan that are in neighbouring countries. But some of those might be in a very difficult situation. They might be stuck in somewhere like Qatar and be running out of money because, you know, they won't be able to work or have anything to live on. And I think that's also going to be concerning for them. So that's the government's current focus, but I also have concerns about people who are stuck in Afghanistan, who it may not be safe for them to be there. So I'm certainly going to be putting pressure on the government to address those issues.
And let's move it to the local constituency then. What is being done in Enfield in terms of maybe housing, helping these people? And could you offer maybe charities or collection places that individuals can help these Afghanistan refugees?
Yeah, first of all, that Enfield has agreed to take some Afghan refugees. They were all put into a hotel in Enfield. So I think the council is working through them, looking at sort of if there's any children, like trying to help the children, safeguarding issues. Also, some of them are in bigger family units. So I think they wants to try and see what housing is available for them to move them out of the hotels. The response from the public has been great in relation to offering support for people from Afghanistan. I know St John's Church opposite my office have done a phenomenal job in collecting clothing for people from Afghanistan. So they've had an absolutely amazing response. There are a number of organisations out there, and I even know one or two people that have offered housing, offered their they've got spare space in their accommodation. They've offered that up for some of the refugees. So it's been a fabulous response locally from the community. I think if they go on the council's website or the Home Office website, there should be some further information about how to get involved and what to do. Locally the response has been tremendous, and I just hope that everyone who has been placed in Enfield is able to be accommodated properly soon.
Let's switch the focus though to local issues, and you've been backing Secondhand September campaign, which is helping the North London Hospice and Oxfam as well. And you know, people have commented this, I wouldn't like to say, but this is the second time in a few months that you have been a fashion icon, Bambos. A lot of people saw the photo of you in your new suit, looking very proud of a shrewd purchase there. But the cause also, you know, we're having a laugh there, but has a lot of benefits to help local charities and reduce waste from fashion. Will you be buying more products this way going forward?
Well, having seen the quality of the clothing in the North London Hospice shop and also some of the other charity shops in Palms Green, I'll certainly be giving them a look. Somebody posted a comment saying they were torn because they were pleased I was highlighting the need to stop secondhand shops, but I'd kind of like exposed their little secret about, you know, where to get good affordable clothing. So. I think more people should think twice before buying fast fashion. I think, you know, it is bad for the environment, and we do need to like think carefully. If we can, you know, share clothes with other people or recycle or buy things secondhand, then that's always to be encouraged.
Yeah, it's a great lesson to be learned there. And just to kind of repeat that for people, it's Secondhand September campaign. Now, you have been visiting people door to door as well this month. Has it been nice to be able to do more of this with restrictions lifted? We've kind of talked to you a few times about how it's progressed from meeting in person, but you couldn't go too close, face to face. And now, would you say that it's a little bit more normal now?
Yeah, it does feel a lot more normal. I was out door knocking on Sunday. And yeah, it was good to see people, that they were happy to see me, good to chat to them about the issues they were concerned about. So they had a whole range of issues, you know, ranging from, you know, fly tipping to LTNs to crime to some quite unusual issues. But yeah, you had the run-of-the-mill stuff you'd expect when you're going out door knocking. So it was good to speak to people again and to rebuild that sort of that trust with them and just get to know them, get them reacquainted once again, face to face.
What would you say was the biggest issue that you saw then, the most popular / unpopular, you know, some of them might be bad issues, that people brought to your attention?
Well, in the area I was doing, it was speeding. So I think there was concerns about speeding. I think the a little bit of fly tipping in a particular hotspot. The LTNs, believe it or not, didn't come up that much, even though this area was one that was affected by it, although they probably benefited more in that area than other areas. So it was a bit of a mixed bag, but they were the main ones that people came up with.
And finally, you've mentioned it there, fly tipping, waste issues. It's kind of a hot topic at the moment. A lot of people are discussing it. And this is something that we have discussed a few months ago. Again, a lot of these issues are kind of recurring, and we're following up to see if there is progress. But do you believe that on this issue that the council has moved forward on it?
Yeah, I think the council, I don't often name check people, but Councillor Rick Jaw, since he's been in charge of this area, has done a phenomenal job. If you follow his Twitter, his social media is excellent, because he focuses on the before and after, where there's been fly tipping, and he has been taking a very robust position about going after people who do fly tip. So I think it's I think the council has put more money into it and is investing more and trying to make sure the area looks smarter and better. It won't necessarily stop all fly tipping, but it looks a lot better than it has done for a long time. So credit to Enfield Council for sorting that out.
So we move on to the community questions now, and many, many people have actually messaged in about the proposed draft local plan. Many people are angry that the Greenbelt areas are being proposed to build on, whereas others will have unusually large buildings. There's questions over how Enfield Council or developers will pay towards adding extra amenities at a time. I mean, Bambos, can you give us some insight into this? Because one of the first questions that I had to put to you on this issue was, realistically, can people actually oppose this? I had Andrew message in, and he said that he's attended to lots of meetings before about proposed building, proposed other things in the area, and he felt like the council doesn't listen, that there's no way for residents to actually have their voice heard.
It is difficult, because when you oppose something, even though you might have a visceral dislike to it, you have to formulate that objection in planning law. So it's one of those things where if the planning law allows it, it will get planning permission, irrespective of, you know, however much we dislike it. So I think the key there is to get more savvy about sort of things, about arguments we can object to. And clearly, if it's going to have an impact on, if it's just so big, if it's going to have an adverse impact on services, if there's a scale and massing issue, those are all good things that we can object to. If there's going to be an increase in the volume of traffic, these are all good reasons to object to things. And when I have made objections, which is frequently to big developments, these are things that I have stated in my objections. So I do think we need to be clear as to what we're objecting to and why. But we also need to make sure that it's done in such a way that, you know, that the whole community responds together and follows those issues, and we do act as one. Because I think sometimes developments happen because people don't hear about them or don't respond to them quickly enough. And we need to work together. So we need the sharing of information is really, really important, and we must never have the local community cut out of it. We must have a very strong, active civic voice that is heard and is responsive to applications.
Well, this is something that Joanne messaged about, saying that she's angry over not proper consultation process, and that the developers, I don't know if anybody else from the council was involved with this or if it is totally away from the council, but it's seemingly that they've reached these plans without discussing this first with local residents. So do you believe that going forward that people's voices will be heard? Do you think that there will be more proper consultation processes?
Well, I was concerned by the government's proposals in relation to planning, because that seemed to give local residents less of a say, and that clearly is unacceptable. And I think they've had a bit of a rebellion and their fingers burnt by the Chesham and Amersham by-election result. So I do hope the government will listen to people. I think what used to happen in the past was, if there was a big development, you had a pre-application planning panel that would actually, people could go to, they could ask questions of the councillors and the developers and the officers. And then that panel would report back to the full planning committee about their findings. And obviously the developers, it does cost a lot of money to submit a planning application. I imagine many of them would have had some sort of contact with the council beforehand. Otherwise, you know, and hopefully that would deter many of them, but maybe not all of them. So I think it's a case of swings and roundabouts here. I think it's kind of, a consultation can always be better, and we need to make sure that it is better. And obviously the developers will have had some sort of communication with the council about their intentions. They won't necessarily come out of the blue. But there can never be enough time, in my view, for proper consultation. And I think that that is an area where we do need to see far more investment in, because it isn't always great and people feel unhappy when it's done badly.
One of the next points of problem that people have sent in to me, and like I said, that this will take up a few more minutes of your time, Bambos, but that there is a lot of discussion on this. It seems to be the hot topic in the area at the moment. The next question was, shouldn't people be taking arable land from use that could be used for farming instead of the dilapidated brown site areas in the borough that could be built on? Somebody also suggested that office spaces that are less likely to be used after COVID could also be used to build housing. One of the explanations or questions that people sent in was saying, is this because it's easier for people that are making buildings to build in a big area rather than changing little areas here and there? I mean, what is the logic behind that, Bambos, to not use sites and areas that probably have some amenities as well already there?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm sure developers will tell you it's always easier to build something that's from scratch on a vacant piece of land than to try and convert something that was used as something else beforehand. So I think and I do agree that, you know, where office buildings are available to be converted, then, you know, if they can be done in a very sensitive and sensible way, then happy to do that. In relation to brownfield sites, we need to be a bit careful, because some brownfield sites are for industry and retail, and they're earmarked for that purpose. And if you build on that, then it means you can't then use that for any job opportunities that come your way in the borough. So you are sort of replacing jobs with housing if you allow development there. So I think we need to be a bit careful about that. I know everyone's been working from home over the last 18 months and not been going to, you know, shops as much, ordering a lot of stuff online. But there is a danger that you might stifle any growth by building on brownfield land. So I don't say no, but I think we need to tread cautiously there.
With that situation, though, people would argue that brown sites are maybe more favourable than taking away precious green land in terms of the protected area.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I think once you concrete over something and that's it, it's lost, and you can't then go back. So I think I think we do need to protect the green belt. We need to make sure that we do have, we do respect the environment. We're already in a situation in relation to biodiversity where species are being, you know, the extinction rate is rapidly increasing. So I think depriving animals of their habitat is quite worrying if we go down that path in that way, or by building on greenbelt.
One of the final questions is about the Cruise Hill area. Again, people have messaged in saying this will decimate one of the most revered horticultural places in Europe. A lot of kind of horticulturalists message in saying this is one of the most valuable places. It's looked to across the continent as one of the areas for growth, for investigation, for research. Why is that being allowed to be given up?
Yep. I don't know the exact reasons, but I imagine because of the proximity to a local train station, and the fact that there's already been development in all the nurseries that are there already with the and cafes and other things where there is already some development there. I think that's probably what was behind the council's thinking. But clearly there needs to be far more investment in local services and transport links and that sort of stuff. So I'm not convinced that Cruise Hill is necessarily ready to be a development sort of location. But I'm guessing that was the thinking behind the council's view on that.
And the final one following up from that in terms of transport, in terms of amenities, is there any way that a council can force, when people are doing these plans, to contribute a certain amount of money or in terms of taxation to be able to pay towards improving roads, improving schools or adding schools, precious doctors, hospital spaces, because inevitably there'll be a rise in population because of this. How can we safeguard the future of the already overstretched amenities in the area?
Yeah, in the past with the development, there was something called Section 106 money. And that money was money paid by the developer to offset a particular problem that was caused by the developer. So, for instance, if there was going to be an increase in school places, then that money would go towards providing more school places. If there was going to be an additional impact on traffic, then that money would go to pay for road calming measures or some other means. So there has been that in the past. There's something called the SIL, which is a levy on developers, but it's dependent on, it's worked out on a local level and it's worked out on where the development is and how many units it is. So I think that's also money that can go towards providing these additional services. So the short answer is that developers are forced to pay for certain services and certain things that have been affected by the development.
And I guess in the long term as well, by having more residents there, they will pay more council tax and I guess increase revenue in the longer term. So short term, there seems to be a solution. Longer term, that would increase income, wouldn't it, Bambos?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. The more properties that are built, the more council tax is charged and the more people will pay, which will then help the council with their finances.
So let's move it on to Sophie's question. She's moved it on to a nationwide issue and has asked Bambos, how can we protect our democratic right to vote? I have an ID, but the elections bill seems to only want to disenfranchise people who are likely to vote Labour. How can this be allowed?
Well, I do think the bill is an abomination. I think it does make it harder for people to vote. It's suggesting that it's trying to resolve a problem that's a fraud, but there have only been 7 fraud convictions in the last, I don't know how many years, but it's a perceived problem and it's just a cover to make it harder for people to vote. And most governments should be making it easier for people to vote, not harder. I've met with the RNIB who've got serious concerns about people who are blind or partially sighted who find it difficult enough to vote with our current system. And this just makes it even harder for them. And also some people don't hold some photo ID. Some people don't have a driving license. Some people may not have had a passport yet. So that there might be issues as to having to prove who you are to vote. So I do have serious concerns about this bill. This bill is something we voted against at second reading and will no doubt vote against when it comes back from committee for report and third reading.
Andreas is asking about a campaign that you're backing is Long Live Locals. He's asked, my question is, can you pour a perfect pint?
I'd like to think I can. I can certainly drink a perfect pint, but I didn't do that much bar work when I was a student. So I think I really was behind the bar, you know, the pumps putting pints. But I'd like to think I could do a decent job. I've seen people do it really well in the past, certainly in the Strangers Bar in the Commons. I've watched quite closely as they've poured the odd pint or two. So I'm willing to give it a bash.
And just continuing there from Long Live Locals campaign, what can people do to help out the local area in that sense?
I think just shop locally, use local restaurants, go to local shops. I think it's really important if we want to see the best in our community. You know, local businesses they employ local people and that money gets circulated in the local economy, so it's a virtuous circle. And I do think that if we or went to our local, had a drink there, which, went to the restaurant, ate out and shopped locally, I think it would certainly help the local community and the local economy.
So Michael has pointed out that you highlighted that prosecutions are at a record low and retweeted Sarah Jones's comment that Labour has a plan to put victims first, boost community policing and bring criminals to justice. What is this plan, Bambos?
Well, to start with, I mean, it's shocking that we don't have, that there are so few convictions for rape. That has to be absolutely appalling. And that more often than not, victims, one of the reasons for that is that people, that there's a delay in the system, a delay in the complaints going to court, and that the victims are not always treated the way they should be, and that puts them off going to court, which leads to there being fewer convictions. So I think trying to, number one, have a victims law and framing our policy around the needs of the victim, making sure that they get certain information, that they're properly treated, that will help encourage them to give evidence and for things to go more. But you also need to invest in policing. So I think community policing is fantastic. I cannot speak highly enough of community policing. We used to have 6 police officers about 15 years ago in Enfield per ward. We now have between 3, 3.5, and 4 in most wards, and I think that's just still quite a low number, particularly when there are about 10,000 police officers per ward, 10,000 constituents per ward. So so I think community policing certainly will make a difference, but also just the manner in which you do things and making sure that, what's that phrase, justice delayed is justice denied. So trying to make sure the courts work properly and that it is all built around the needs of the victim. So I think that would really help make a difference.
The question always is, though, with the justice system, with police, where's this funding going to come from? We started the show with talking about the national insurance rise. Inevitably, there has to be some sort of tax rise. Where would this money come from?
Again, really good question. But I think with justice, I mean, the government's solution to everything is lock everyone up, but it costs about 38,000 to, you know, lock one person up a year. And part of the community policing issue is that they might help prevent people actually getting into the criminal justice system in the first place. So I think you would actually make savings if you invested more in police in the first place. So I think it can still be funded from within existing budgets, but you'd have to like ring fence the savings you would make from the reduction in crime. And it's not just the police, it's also about sort of the wider community. It's also about the, you know, having things for young people to do, and making sure that people don't get down the path of the, you know, of the criminal justice system. There are a number of organisations that try and divert young people away from crime. So I think all these things are part and parcel of the needs to try and invest more in community policing. And I think if you do invest, then it will pay dividends locally.
But if there was a source, you know, in case the plans were not self-sufficient, you had to spend more, the realistic question is, where would this come from? Would it be a wealth tax? Would it be, I guess, as you said there, not an increase in national insurance, but what area of the economy could be taxed that wouldn't affect COVID recovery?
Yeah, well, at the moment, the police is paid for by the Mayor of London. So, and I know that Sadiq Khan has paid for more policing, so the levy has gone up. So we've all paid for it, more of it in our council tax. So so there has been that increase there. I'd be going above my pay grade if I was to suggest that the Mayor of London would put it up again. But that has been one option that has been considered. So it would depend on what the you know, what would be done locally, but that's been done in the past.
Let's move it to Chris's question, and he's asked, what newspaper or news outlet do you think is the best at the moment? He feels that a lot of newsprint is too sensationalist and leaning far to the right. Is there any good centre / left wing products?
Well, I regularly read, but also listen to the podcast for New Statesman. But I think it's sometimes good to, from a political point of view, to see what the opposition are up to. So it's still worth just occasionally. I don't recommend this, and I wouldn't sort of necessarily suggest people buy newspapers from views they don't agree with. But if you're able to like sort of get hold of a free copy, maybe from the local library, and thumb through it and just see what they're saying. My go-to, I mean, certainly The Independent and The Guardian are my go-to newspapers, and they usually have a lot of really good information, in-depth reports. And I think it's, you know, there's a lot of stuff there on social media, but there are lots of good podcasts as well. So those would be, I mean, you know, BuzzFeed have been very good in the past, so there's stuff that goes online. Huffington Post are now breaking stories in the UK as well. So there's lots of other outlets online that people can go to.
Do you agree with Chris's sentiment, though, that newsprint at the moment, in general, is too sensationalist and leaning far to the right? Is that something you'd agree with?
I would probably agree with that. The only thing I would say is that only people above a certain age would still get newsprint. I think most people get their news from other sources.
And just for fairness and for people listening in, do listen to my interviews with Bim, Afalami and Daisy Cooper as well, because I'll be asking the same question to them so that we can get a fair kind of view across the spectrum, as you said yourself there, Bambos, to get both sides of the story. Tristan has asked, though, you said this month in your local newsletter that the UK is a major contributor to the world's plastic crisis, generating more plastic waste per person than any other country except the USA. He's asked, why aren't single-use plastics banned? He's asked a follow-up question, but I think that's a really big issue at the moment that a lot of people are talking about.
Yeah, they should be banned, and we should look at some other alternatives to plastic. So we should look at more, plant-based containers or utensils. Looking at sort of trying to get rid of some of this plastic would be a really good idea. And looking at things that are either multi-use or are used from sustainable sources is something that we definitely need to be doing, and we need to do that soon. Because I don't know what the some plastic takes many dozens of years to decompose, and then it leaves. It's not good for the environment either, and particularly if we've seen pictures of birds that have eaten things like plastic things, and assuming that they were food, and they've gone on to die from ingesting harmful plastic. So we should definitely get rid of single-use plastics, and I totally support Tristan, and I'm certainly doing what I can to help the government move quicker on this.
Well, he's followed up by saying he understands that for some rare medical usages that they may need it to be used, you know, but he said, should the government or yourselves be more tough and force the hands of producers to cut back on these? I mean, should there be a law introduced, maybe a time frame?
Yeah, I think there should be. I think we do need to move to getting away from single-use plastics, and the sooner that happens, the better. I think all but in the most exceptional cases should you get rid of single-use plastics. So, and I do think that with the government behind this push. I think that it will happen. It can happen quite soon. If we get electric cars in, you know, 10 years time, then we can certainly get rid of single-use plastics a lot sooner than that.
And I suppose you said there that you want this to happen across the nation, but at home, have you introduced more kind of plastic saving methodologies? I don't know, with your food or when you cook, do you wrap it up in maybe a reusable plastic box? And also at the office, maybe in Parliament or maybe in your constituency, are you moving towards a more green, eco-friendly strategy?
Yeah, very much so. So certainly walk a lot more, but in relation to what I eat, sometimes you've got no choice but to buy things that are wrapped in plastic from the supermarket, even if they're foods that are good for you. And I think there is responsibility from the supermarkets to get rid of single-use plastics. You know, you might buy, I don't know, some, let's think of an example, some asparagus in a plastic tray with sort of plastic film covering it. So again, that's that stuff, you know, the tray might be recyclable, but the covering may not be. And so that's something that, you know, we would need to put pressure on the supermarkets to change.
Well, this is something that I was going to ask you. Do you think that the strategy of recycling and putting the onus on the consumer is wrong, and that there needs to be, as you said, there's more pressure on actually changing the mind frame, that it should be the shopping markets or wherever people are buying these products, that actually it's their fault for not changing?
I do agree with that. I think it's we can only go so far, but I think the big producers of the plastics are the people that contract with supermarkets and supermarkets themselves. And with the best one in the world, sometimes you can only recycle so much, but some of it will have to go to waste. And that will cause harm to the planet, whether it's the way that the waste is disposed of or whether that plastic ends up in the ecosystem.
So we move to the final question from Ian, and I think this is quite a fun one. He said, I saw that you had an Enfield Town FC visit. What did you think of their little home ground? And then he's got one last fun question.
I loved it. I mean, I used to go to Cardhatch, you know, when it was an athletics track, and you know, they had the field for field events. So, yeah, I used to do athletics there for the school. In fact, I even have my certificate for being runner-up in the under-17s discus. So from there, so I'm very familiar with the place from what it was in the past. I think it's a lovely little ground, and I'll certainly be going back to support the towners. So yeah, very much love the place.
Yeah, that could have been an alternate history, couldn't it? Bambos Charalambos, you know, greatest discus thrower of all time, or an Olympian. but yeah, he's asked as well, will you be visiting more often going forward?
Definitely, yeah. Have high hopes for Enfield Town. They started off really well this season. I think they're playing. I saw them in a cup game. I think I've got a cup tie tonight. So I wish them well against Hadley. I'll certainly be going back there. And I do like watching local football. It's you know, it just reminds me of like what football should all be all about, when you take away all the money and nonsense that it comes with the game at a higher level.
I suppose as well, it's not too much of a culture shock for you, because Enfield are blue and white, similarly to your boys in blue of Stamford Bridge Chelsea. But Ian asked, as I said there, one last final question. He put two in, and I thought they were both so good that they had to be included. He said also, just a general football question, who is your favourite player ever?
My favourite Chelsea player ever would have to be Gianfranco Zola. I was also a fan of Pat Nevin. I don't know if it's a size thing, but they would probably be my Gianfranco Zola would be my top choice. There are lots of candidates for that, but he was just so skillful and such a really nice man outside football. So yeah, I've got a lot of time for Gianfranco Zola.
I suppose we're asking the hard questions here. That's probably one of the hardest ones put to you this week.
That is really tough.
But in terms of it, I hope that people have had their questions answered and have feel that the community has been listened to here. As always, Bambos, it is great to be able to chat to you and get responses to what the people need and want to know. So, yes, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Jason. All the best.